This episode is brought to you by HP Instant Ink. No one is reading your mind, but HP Instant Ink knows when your printer is running low and sends new cartridges before you run out. So you never have to think about ink. For details, visit hp.com/instantinkspotify. Conditions apply. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Episode of the Washed Up Emo Podcast. Today we welcome Colby Mancasola from Knapsack. Newly reformed reunion plans have been announced, and of course it's a great chance to catch up on the past, present, and future of the band. So Colby, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much. It's good to be here.
Awesome. What got you into music early on? Have you always been in California?
I grew up in Northern California in a town called Redding. It's like 100,000 people now with no college. Back then it was maybe half that or a little more.
Wow.
My dad's a lot of people say musical family, and they mean a family of musicians. But I grew up in a musical family, just in the sense of always being around, always having music playing, whether it was the Beatles or Led Zeppelin. Or I even remember a time when my dad got home from work and was talking my ear off about how great Van Halen Diver Down was, or one of those early records. Could have been Women and Children First, but I digress. it was an interesting thing that set up, which was, how do you rebel when, like, my parents are super cool and super young and great and liberal, and I didn't have teen angst or adolescent angst in the traditional way, because it was a good time. My family's wonderful to this day. They're some, they're my best friends and wonderful support system. And so how do you rebel, and what does that look like, and what kind of music could possibly piss your parents off when, your dad is like, don't turn off the car yet, we need to finish, this Led Zeppelin song, or, something like that. So I think the first thing that was like, it didn't piss my parents off, because they're pretty hard to piss off with music. Mm-hmm. Maybe modern country would do it. I think early, like, hip hop, like buying 12 inches, was fascinating, because it was something that you had to go to a special record store in the city to do. And then it was also like the thing where my dad, what the biggest rise you could sort of get out of my dad was like, I totally don't get this. Like, there's nothing about this that speaks to me at all. Mm-hmm. And so, early, like, hip hop 12 inches, was like the first thing that I sort of came upon that was like, oh, this could maybe be my thing, even though I'm a white kid who lives, 3.5 hours from the closest major metropolitan area. Like, my existence is very much not an urban existence, but at the same time, there was a lot of mystery to it, and it was a whole new world, and it was codified, and it was hard to buy the records, so there was like some exclusivity, and that was like the first taste of of that. And, you know, it felt very different than the stuff that I would get into later, whether it was indie rock or hardcore or whatever. But if you look at those, like, descriptors, some of them are very, there's a lot of commonality there where it's like, oh, exclusivity and sort of like this codified community. And that stuff started to, like, get interesting to me. And also it was just stuff that always had to do with, like, the city, which I was always drawn to. And my family was one that, you know, came to San Francisco, whether it was for baseball games or other things, pretty, you know, common, pretty often. So that sort of musically was like a seed that got planted. And then that quickly turned into, like, you know, maybe I saw something on 120 Minutes back in the day. And then that, you know, and I saw patches on the people that were older than me, you know, punk jackets, and starting to put, like, what that looked like together.
What was the gateway? Do you feel like those 12 inches were the gateway into being like, well, okay, this isn't on the radio. This isn't, you know, this isn't connecting. People don't know about this. And then you're seeing the patches, you're seeing the stickers, you're reading the liner notes. What was, like, the gateway to being like, holy crap, there's this whole world out there?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I always joke with the people that I grow up with that there was a summer where, like, all the breakdance kids came back to school in September as, like, punk kids. And I always thought, like, that would make for a funny screenplay, or to somehow tie that into a movie would be funny. But, you know, I got into the first two 7 Seconds records. Were not 7 Seconds wasn't a local band, but Reno/Sacramento was close enough to where you know, people maybe knew Kevin or someone from 7 Seconds, or they weren't around, but, like, there was a little bit of a local angle there. So, you know, it's like I probably heard the first couple 7 Seconds records when I first, like, heard the Minor Threat record, but there was something about that that was that spoke to me a little more, and just felt like it was closer, and it was maybe happening kind of around us in a way. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I bought those records, but, you know, I at the same time very much needed to go over to the REM replacements path and ease into things from that way, where it was like, oh, what 7 Seconds and Minor Threat and those guys are doing is cool. And, like, you know, I get that from, like, a certain perspective. You know, I totally got wrapped up in the mystery around, like, the first couple REM records, or, you know, all but the last two replacements records. I love the last two replacements records too, but, like, the mystery was gone, right? And the camaraderie of this idea of a band was gone. But, like, through high school, though, you know, that was my thing. I was never I wasn't a punk kid in high school by any stretch. I was very much like what's now called indie rock at the time was like, you know, American alternative college rock was totally my jam.
Was there a record store? Was there, like, a mail order? Was it just going to shows and local shows and kids talking about it?
There was no record store, to be very clear about that. There was no record store. You could drive to the only Amoeba. I don't know how well you know the West Coast, but on the West Coast, there Amoeba's are three it. Amoeba Records, Berkeley, San Francisco, and L.A. At the time, it was only in Berkeley. And then there were also a couple other great record stores in Berkeley to where – and that would say coming from where I grew up, stopping at Berkeley and not going into the city saved you, like, a half hour to an hour, depending on traffic. So if you could do that, so, like, a great trip would be, you know, go to Berkeley and shop for records at Amoeba and a couple other places that were around at the time. And then if you could go to a show at either Gilman or the Berkeley Square, you could just drive back home and, you know, you get home at 2, 3, 4 in the morning. But that was a pretty good way to spend a day when you grew up where I grew up and, you know, you're 20 years old or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But no, a lot of mail order. When Lookout Records came around, it's funny, I'm friends with Chris who used to pack my – he ended up running Lookout, but at the time he used to pack the mail order envelopes and write little notes in there. And so to this day, I'll still, like, geek out with him and be like – And he's like, we've had this conversation 17 times. It's not that interesting. But, you know, I would always be like, remember the one time that I ordered such and such record and he wrote such and such? And he's like, do you know how many of those envelopes I packed? Like, this is – come on.
That's awesome.
But, yeah, so mail order, of course, was happening. And when I met Blair from Knapsack, like I said, I was very much like an REM, Replacements, Pixies, Dinosaur Jr. kid, and he was like a straight edge kid, and so his bands were like Judge and Youth of the Day and stuff like that. And so we started to find like this common ground with bands that were, you know, that were sort of like the peanut butter chocolate, like meeting in the middle a little bit. And it's funny because sometimes it would just be for one song where it'd be like, oh, the record shit, but listen to this one song. They do that one thing that like they get it, they the pieces come together and they do it right, you know. Or yeah. It's funny, it was like the first couple of Fugazi records, but none of the songs the Gee sang on, because that was like, that was too abrasive, you know. It's like what we were looking for was like very much you know, the just kind of to mix and match certain pieces of both worlds.
Well, obviously the common theme is just so funny that each time when these bands meet, there's one guy that's into hardcore or like straight edge most times, and then there's another guy that kind of came in from the indie world and then out popped what, you know, kind of what Knapsack was. This happened so many times.
But yeah, so mail order was a funny thing back then because you wouldn't always even get the records that you ordered. You know, it used to be that you would put down your second and third choices if they decided that they had run out of that record, and then you'd end up with something. And I think, I don't know if you remember that band, Four Walls Falling.
This yes, is probably definitely.
Going down a boring path, but I remember there was a time when Blair had ordered a record, and I forget from who, but probably Revelation. And we were excited to get it. And so it was like checking the mailbox after school multiple days in a row, or even maybe multiple weeks in a row. And then he got like the note that was like, we didn't have your first choice, but check out this record by Four Walls Falling. And I don't know those guys. I'm sure they're nice guys, but it was just a disappointment. It wasn't the record that it had been ordered. And it was like, what's this? This is not what I signed up for, you know? Mm-hmm. And you were sort of stuck with it. And that's how it went.
Wow. How did you guys meet? Was it again over music, or you saw, you know, a sticker or a patch or something?
Blair was friendly with my friend Joel. And then ultimately my friend Ken, and we sort of became Blair, Ken and I became like, you know, the trio running around together, and we had a band together before we went to Davis. So, I knew Blair in high school a little bit, I think, but again, he was pretty punk. Or hardcore or straight edge, whatever you want to call it. And I was, you know, I mean, there were probably some years early on in there where I maybe, you know, was showing up to high school with eyeliner on. So we were inhabiting different worlds. And then it kind of came together through the mutual friends. And we went to junior college, and we stayed in Reading, and we did a band called Downtime. There's a cassette demo that got reviewed in Maximum Rock and Roll and maybe mail ordered by five people. I don't know. someone showed up to a Knapsack show early on. It was like, look what I have. And we're like, destroy that thing.
Oh, wow.
kill that man and destroy that tape.
Yeah.
So we did this band together, and that was, you know, that was like an interesting mix of things, because Ken, who played guitar on that stuff and is an amazing guitar player, was very much from my camp of like Dinosaur Jr., Replacements, whatever that we were into at that time. But Blair was front man. And so it was starting to be, it was feeling our way around of what like that all might sound like if you put it together and you tried to kind of land somewhere that that was a place that we kept gravitating to, you know, through it's the, you know, like the one song off of 10 different records that we had kind of glommed onto and said, this is what we like.
Yeah, I feel like that was always when you were on like a road trip or something with a bunch of friends and you had to find that one song or that one record that everyone could agree to.
Yeah.
And that kind of happened to turn into, you know, Knapsack. Did you guys go to UC Davis? Did you know you both were going there?
We planned to go together.
Wow.
Yeah, so we planned to go together. I was hot on the idea of the college radio station there is great and has been around and has been really strong and has always been freeform since I think the late 60s. And so I was hot on the idea of that I was going to go there for that reason. And Blair and I had the same major, which was rhetoric and communications. I mean, we were, you know, it's like we were pretty inseparable at the time that we moved to Davis together. We were, you know, we were in a band together. We were taking a bunch of classes together up in Reading at the junior college. And we'd, you know, we lived together when we got to Davis. And so.
And then so like through that, I mean, was it. Was the band kind of, I guess the during it, was the band taking the front seat? Was it shows, music, class? When did the band kind of turn into more than you guys had thought, or was it getting kind of serious?
The band was broken up when we left to go to Davis, and there had been that review in Maximum Rock and Roll, and there was a record industry guy who got in touch with us, and there was a guy who wanted to put out a 7-inch too. And so it kind of became this thing of like, there's enough interest that if we just keep these people, if we can string these people along and say, well, don't worry about it, like, yeah, we're going to change the name of the band, but other than that, like, you'll still like it. Then that'll buy us time to sort of like figure out what we do next, because we were moving to Davis and we didn't really know people that we didn't know how to put a band together. You know, we didn't know how to like move to a new town, figure out how to not live at our parents' house, figure out how to pass classes at a university and do a band at the same time, let alone like all the fun stuff, like having a radio show that started at 3 a.m. or going to parties or skipping school or whatever. What, like, it was a lot for us to sort of sort out, but we figured we might have a chance to do it if we could buy ourselves a little time. So as there was interest in someone wanting to put a 7-inch out, or this other guy who was from a bigger label wanting to like do a record deal, it was like, okay, well, let's not blow this opportunity. Let's sort of fake it until it's a real band again thing. And that's what we did.
So you guys kind of reconvened, got, you know, figured out, and then the kind of started to put together Knapsack.
Yeah, we did. There was a band. We had tried to do – we did Knapsack with a couple different bass players as a trio, and then there was a band called Pivot in Sacramento that was like a really cool, like post-hardcore band. And we booked a tour. I'm skipping ahead because somehow we had booked a tour, and we said we booked this tour and we're not even really a band. We've been patching these shows together with different bass players, but that's not going to work out. We don't have one right now. And so two of the guys from Pivot were like, well, why don't we'll just join the band, or we'll do the tour or whatever. And then that way you'll have a bass player and a guitar player. And those guys, you know, it was great. That was Rod and Jason, who we made the first record with. And that was great because those guys were the only people that we knew that were in another band that had, like, that we could talk to about stuff. You know, like, they were super into Discord Records. Like, they were, like, really into Lungfish, for instance, or things like that, where we had touch points where, you know, it's like, as you're starting to do a band or to describe what you're after or to put a song together, to have that sort of common language to be able to say, like, oh, this is sort of like the, you know, whatever you might call, like, this is sort of like the Dissonant Sonic Youth breakdown, or or this part is sort of like the, you know, whatever you might want to call a part of a song, or you know, or admit to aping from another band. But there was that commonality where it was like, okay, so we all sort of talk the same language, and this is going to work.
That's awesome.
At that point, we had a cassette demo of two songs, I think, and we had a band, and we went on tour, and then things kind of started moving fast from there. And I should have said at the very start of this interview that it's any old friend that I've mentioned, if they heard that I was doing an interview where I was supposed to recap anything that happened longer than 6 months ago, they would die laughing because I have a notoriously bad memory.
That's okay. That's why we have the time to work through it. You can go back and correct things and it's totally fine. I wanted to kind of think that 94, you guys had signed to Goldenrod, correct?
And we just did a 7-inch. So
which one, the True to Form or the Stuntman? Both of them?
No, I want to say neither. We did the Trainwrecker 7-inch, I think, on Goldenrod. It's blue. It's got a train on the front, so it's probably Trainwrecker.
Yes. And that was also home to No
Knife.
They
were doing a bunch of cool stuff, and they were very much kind of in San Diego was a really fun place to hang out at that time, and there was a lot of great bands coming out of there, whether it was like the No Knifes and the Boilermakers that were doing something more similar to what we did, or if it was the Rocket from the Crypts and the Drive Like Jehus that were just amazing, or like, you know, we'd end up at parties with like the guys from Supernova who were just a really good time, and it was just a great time. So we started to be able to go up to the Northwest, and we had met some like-minded people. You know, we did a show with Sunny Day Real Estate before their first record came out. We were to this day big fans of the Tree People, and certainly huge Tree People fans at the time. Mm-hmm. Went up and were able to play a show with those guys. We met John and Polly from 764 Hero. We met the Hush Harbor guys, and so that was all happening. And plus, it was a weird time. So we would play go up there and play with bands that were on K Records, or, you know, like that were doing sound-wise, we're doing something very different than what we did. But it was all kind of the same thing at that time, which was a cool thing about that time.
Well, I was
very different than now.
I was laughing kind of looking through all the bands you're sort of associated with and mentioning and being on. You know, coming to be on Alias, it was like Archers, Yola Tango. How the hell did you get roped into post-hardcore? Like, you know, touring with Pavement and Jawbox and Drive Like Jehu. I just was like, you know, where does that... It's just funny, like, you would think that it wouldn't turn that way, but it did.
Well, it sort of goes back to the... like you said earlier, you sort of play your mutual aesthetic. I mean, the records that we were listening to... When we moved to Davis and we're down at the college radio station 24/7, I mean, at that point, it's like I was done listening to the records that you might think that the first cut or that the Knapsack records sound like, and on to like getting really into the Pavements and those different things, and so. But it's like the music you play and the music you're listening to that minute are usually very different. You know, it's like. We had gelled around this thing that we were really into at a certain time, and that was what that band was going to be. But that didn't stop us from listening to, you know, records on Merge that were completely different, or things like Uncle Tupelo that were completely different, or, you know, it's but we were never going to be a band that whose next record sounded like Uncle Tupelo.
Yeah.
But that's just, I think that's, it's that time, it's the time, it's, I think it, that's a part of what was going on at that time, but I think it's also a part of being, you know, 25 or whatever we were.
Yeah, but those, I mean, I had read, you know, for this Silver Sweepstakes touring, you know, it was Pavement, Rock from the Crypt, Jawbox, like, those are some fucking awesome tours.
You know, we were definitely accused of living a bit of a charmed existence early on, because, like I said, we had gone up to Seattle and we had made friends with the people I mentioned, who were, you know, super fun and cool. And then we went down to San Diego, and we happened to get to be friends with Paul from Rocket from the Crypt, and he lived in this house with a couple friends that we always stayed at and had a good time at. And then from there, it was like, you know, there was this band, A Miniature, that was awesome. And Mark Trombino played drums on their last record. We got to be friends with those guys and the No Knife guys. And so it all, in those two places, you know, we touring was super fun, or just to drive down there to play a show was super fun. And then, but even in our hometown, we couldn't, you know, I mean, we were never a big band in Davis or Sacramento or anything like that. We were always like this thing that, you know, those towns were into very different kinds of scenes at the time. And what we were trying to do, we had to look for pockets of people that sort of got it, which was not to say that it was like high art or hard to get, but it was just like, more than anything, it was just kind of uncool. Like, no one was – there wasn't a name for it. There wasn't, like it was – I guess more than anything, it was a tough sell. Like, when we would try to book those tours, people would say, you know, what do you sound like? And, you know, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Trying to make that make sense to someone who, you know, who's booking completely different kinds of bands. You know, it's like it was just a very different time.
And then – I wanted to kind of bring up the word – I was going to bring this up later, but it's kind of a good point. I mean, emo, it's obviously synonymous with you guys, good or bad, and you're mentioned as a band from that era and influential and they're referenced. What was – I mean, was it around at that time, so like 95? I mean, and were you – was it at the point where you're trying to get away from it? Was it a blessing or a curse? Because again, I thought from, you know, it, being on Alias, having all those bands, I initially didn't think that. I was just like, these guys are making these super hooky songs. And it just, you know, got roped in.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, so there was a time when everything was something core, right?
Yeah, totally.
And so when emo core came around, the idea that there was this term emo core was just like, well, someone had just thought of another word to stick in front of core.
Yeah.
And I remember being in a car and someone saying, oh, something about like the first Green Day record or something. Oh, it's you know, it's emo core. Or I think even like an early NoFX record, someone was like, oh, that's emo core. But then like, when in more like hardcore environments, the whole like flopping around on the floor,
yep,
screamo thing, that was like, then that was emo. And I was like, well, I don't, you know, at this point, it's like you've got over here, you've got Green Day writing love songs, and that's kind of an uncool whatever. That's a very different thing than what their peers usually do or whatever back then, and you know, early on, certainly different than what Operation Ivy was doing, for instance.
And then
the flop around on the floor like hardcore stuff, those were so completely different. I'm like, well, you're just grabbing at straws. Now it's like it wasn't until the other thing happened, which was the Christie Front Drives and the Minerals and the Boys' Lives and the Giants' Chairs and the No Knives and Jimmy Eat World. When those bands, when we all sort of came together of like, well, every two were included, at least two of those bands.
Yeah.
That was when it was like, okay, the world has decided that, you know, it was confusing at first, but it's not confusing anymore. This is now officially that.
Interesting. Yeah, when I was talking to Jim from Jimmy Eat World, when he was emo, it was like the screamo bands. It was,
yeah,
you know, it was all the, was like super dissonant, you know, it was aggression. It wasn't pop hooks and girls and love.
Yeah.
And so that I had always thought, okay, well, emo screamo. And then it started to just, oh, well, this band, it just got so diluted. Even at that time. And of course the East Coast, West Coast, I love hearing these different stories from all over, you know, what labels. Again, I never messed with Lookout, you know, it was more the East Coast mm-hmm. labels. It was Discord, more so. So it's also interesting
sure.
to regionally what stuff you got into and what you related, to things. But I do think that that point of, yeah, the Mineral Giants tear, you know, Boy's Life, that was definitely, it was like, oh, okay. And of course, you guys were on the Don't Forget to Breathe comp, which was, I think, an introduction for a lot of people, you know, as like a early intro of like, oh, is this what this is? Or what's this scene? Or that was an interest. I mean, that was a compilation big for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Crank was certainly right there in the middle of all that.
Yeah. Did you, what was the, I guess, I mean, before we jump to the, you know, the comp, I think the Alias stuff, I mean, you guys put out a bunch of records for them and, you know, stuck with it. It wasn't, you know, hopping around. And what about that made a great relationship, you know, as you guys made a few records for them?
Well, you had heard, asked earlier, I think you asked, how the hell did we end up on Alias Records? And that came out of, you know, those were the records we were listening to. When we signed to Alias, Archers of Loaf were kings of the world in our circles, you know. Yep. I mean, we loved those records. We had seen Archers live and just thought they were insanely great. And, you know, I'm the record that Alias put out by American Music Club and the record they put out by Yellow Tango, I like those records a lot too. And but that had happened like years before. Mm-hmm. And then Alias sort of went after the North Carolina stuff and they signed Archers of Loaf, Small, that became Small 23. And Eric Bachman had been from the Archers, had been in that band, but had left. And then a band called Picasso Trigger, which was kind of a different thing, but part of the same scene. And we were super hot on that stuff. And so we were, at the time, we were talking to this label called Thirsty Ear, which didn't stick around for very long, but at the time was like, I think it was like Beggar's Banquet, who is UK based, this was going to be like their foray into like a more American based label. Mm-hmm. Or they shared offices with Beggar's in the US or something. I don't know exactly how that all worked. And then we're talking to Mammoth, and Mammoth was a weird label at the time because they had put out some cool records that they put out some cool like indie-ish records, but they had started to flirt with like the post Nirvana gold rush and had put out some really, you know, they'd put out a Seven Mary Three record and they had that swingy big band, Squirrel Nut Zippers. And so that was a weird label. And then the third one that we're talking to was Alias. And, you know, at the time we thought Alias was a cool record. They'd put out some of our favorite, you know, records of recent memory. And they had money to do like an indie label at, like with, you know, people have said like, oh, it's like an indie label, but with major label budgets. The woman Delight, who runs that label, came into some money a long time ago, I think through her husband. And so it's kind of a hobby / passion project for her.
That's awesome.
So that seemed like a good deal. And the reason we stuck around is because when you signed to Alias Records, it's a little bit like the Hotel California. You can come anytime you like, but you can never leave. And we could maybe get to that part of that. In the last year, we've reacquainted ourselves with that phenomenon with them.
Yeah, that's always fun. The, I mean, I'd love to talk about Server Sweepstakes. The Cellophane, I was looking on Spotify, most played song out of your whole catalog.
Yeah, that was a weird time. And to sort of set the stage a little bit, I guess there was a little bit of a false hope that we were going to be like a post Nirvana thing. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, and I think that happened with Sunny Day Real Estate, and their, you know, sort of their single, there was a single on that record when it came out around that same time. People hadn't really figured out what was going to happen after Nirvana, or they hadn't figured out that it wasn't repeatable and that it wasn't going to happen again. So like I said, when we signed to Alias, although that's a small label, like there was interest from Mammoth, who had major label money, or different things like that. And you know, there were trade magazines back then that had us as like, you know, a sought after sort of buzzy, like bidding war type band. Mm-hmm. And so we, there was a little bit of that happening, and some weird stuff happened where there was a time before our first record came out that the music director at K-Rock in LA like flew to see us play in Sacramento, and there was a small group of people that I think thought maybe we were like the next big thing, which clearly we weren't. But for that reason, when our record came out and our record got mixed by this guy who had done big records and things like that, and you know, the label spent a lot on the video. There was a time when it was like that's how it was promoted, and when we were touring behind Silver Sweepstakes, I remember it was like we would play like a total all ages teen center type show one night, and then the next night it was like, oh, there are people from the radio station that you're getting played on and whatever, Baltimore or wherever it was, are going to be there, and they're going to do a ticket giveaway, and you have to sign a thing to be given away. And it was like, but then there weren't very many people at the show, so it like our song getting played on the radio was not working.
Oh, that's interesting.
It was just like a weird mixed up time of like, okay, so like in our minds, and listen, if someone had said, hey, you guys, you know, guess what, high five, you're going to sell a million records, it's not like we were against that, but at the same time, I think we sort of secretly knew, like, well, we know, like, what we're trying to do is a very like tuneful take on a certain thing, but it's still that certain thing. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I don't think this is going to play out the way that those certain people thought it might, you know. And so there was a little bit of a flirtation of like, oh, it's like Cellophane, which you mentioned, you know, was on 12 commercial radio stations throughout the country, and the video got played. It used to be on 120 minutes that if they play your video 5 weeks in a row, that means they're going to move it to the buzz bin, which you probably remember what that is. I don't know if everybody would.
Yeah, no, but definitely
meant,
explain
it meant
that
they were going to play during the daytime,
yeah,
instead of in the middle of the night, right? So 120 minutes was like the alternative show that everybody stayed up to watch to see like weird things like, oh, weird, there's a whatever. I didn't know there was a video to this song. You know, it was the indie rock show on MTV back in the day in the 80s and the 90s. And then so they had the rule of thumb sort of was if they play you 5 weeks in a row, they're going to move it to the daytime, and you're going to be put into regular rotation. And that was the path that many a big band had followed, right? Mm-hmm. And so we got played. It's like, okay, we got played once, and then we got played the next week, and then we got played the next week, and we got played the week after that. And so we got played the four times, and we stayed up to see if we were going to get played the fifth time, which meant like, okay, this is like a new world. You're going to get played on MTV during the day. Like, holy shit, that's crazy. And I was like, nope, that's not going to happen. And that sort of marked, that was like the line in the sand of like, okay, what kind of band are you going to be? Like, okay, now it's official. You are not going to be the daytime MTV band. So you can go back to regular programming, back to this idea of like, you know, you're going to play all ages shows in basements, and that's how most of touring is going to be, you know?
Wow. So from that moment, I mean, did Alias really, that's it. I guess I never thought about that. I mean, it really was that gold rush and being like, who's next? Who's going to make it? And everyone just running as fast as they can to whatever they thought.
Oh, totally. I mean, and listen, we weren't the weirdest band that, you know, people thought that about. I mean, they thought that about Tad, or they thought that about, I mean, any number of like really weird band. I mean, they thought that about the Butthole Surfers, right? I mean, they thought that about any number of like actually really weird bands where we were not, you know,
you guys were a
we
rock
were
band.
Not a weird band. We were just a rock band, but we weren't going to, it wasn't going to be that type of thing probably.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, but you know, it was like going back to it being like a very confusing time when like Silver Sweepstakes was out or coming out. Blair and I graduated from Davis. We opened for Pavement in Sacramento on the Crooked Rain tour. which to us, I mean, that was a hometown show for them because they were from Stockton. That was 20 minutes from where we had graduated from college, 3 days before. And it was the biggest show we'd ever played. It was in a proper theater in Sacramento. And it was a big deal. And then we drove overnight and we played our first show in Boulder, which was with Chrissy Front Drive and at Club 156, which was like the place back in the day. And so it was, I mean, that right there just tells you that it was like worlds colliding and things getting sorted out.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean
And
that.
as much as we loved, like, playing with Pavement was insane and great and super fun, but it's like playing that show with Chrissy Front Drive, it's like, the kids that were there got it on a different level than the people that were just waiting to hear Pavement play.
And then that was when, did you feel, okay, this is what this is. Here are our peers. This is kind of what it's going to be. Because again, from that point of, hey, we've only got played 4 times. Now it's back to, the playing these clubs and kind of doing it on the ground.
It felt more normal to just sort of go back to the original plan anyway. And we played a show. So Christy Front Drive, those guys, some of those guys were in a band called Turnkey. And when Knapsack just had like a demo tape, Turnkey came out on a West Coast tour and we ended up playing a show with them. And so we had said, oh, we'd like to, we'd like to go. We'd love to play in Denver or Boulder sometime. And kind of was the classic thing where it's like you stay in touch. Either you become pen pals or, you keep the phone number for when you're going to book the tour.
Yep.
And they made good on it. It's like they were like, yeah, we remember you guys. We liked your band and come play. We'll do a show. We'll play with you guys. We play at this place, 156. That's all ages. It usually is like sold out. The kids are like really into this stuff there, and it'll be great. And sure enough, it's like we drove and we met those guys. And then I remember meeting the Mineral guys. We were set. We were catching. We did a tour, and then we had to like drive kind of a long ways to catch up with Archers to start playing with Archers. We played like 5 shows with them in the South, and we they there was a, they were playing in Austin, and we said, oh well, we're not on that show, but we'll just go watch it because we really like them. And the Mineral guys came over and they're like, oh, we know who you guys are. You're in that band Knapsack. And it was like that. You had to find your people because
Yeah.
it wasn't that common. So they like came to us and we're like, oh, we're in this band Mineral, we live here in town and we know who you guys are, we like your single or your record. Or I mean, and then one by one that just sort of happened. It happened with Christy Front Drive, it happened with Mineral. We did a tour with Boys Life and we hadn't met them yet, but like the tour got set up because we were fans of each other's bands. And and we got on famously with those guys. And just like one by one, that sort of network came together.
Yeah, it's almost like this the storybook you would think of how it would happen. You're meeting all the right people.
Yeah, but you didn't know.
You didn't know.
You knew that you liked their band a lot, and you knew that they were like the nicest people ever. I mean, come on, Chris from Mineral is like the nicest guy ever,
Yes.
and all those guys are nice. I shouldn't single him out, although he is really fucking nice.
Well, I was
But
the
it's
last
like you
time.
knew. Oh,
Oh,
go
sorry.
ahead.
I was going to say that when I was at South by Southwest, he called me this past year, just called me out of the blue and said, "Hey, I'm recording. Why don't you come over and hang out?" And
Yeah.
then hung out, listened to him record a song, and he's, "Hey, you want to just come over and hang out tomorrow?" I was like, "Yeah, sure." So we just listened to like his record and told me a bunch of stuff. And then it was just the most relaxed, chill, like I don't know, like you're instantly like friends. And there, I just think the in those times, the good people pop out and are those connectors. I think Eric from Christy
Yeah.
Front Drive, same thing.
Super, super nice guy.
A connector. And just,
Yeah.
I like you, I like you, let's play together. We have the same feeling. And then, I mean, that's that community part that I think is so lost today. It's through text. I mean, we've only emailed and, talked, but it's like it was that face-to-face connection, the music, came first, and then you had this connection when you met.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, listen, those tours weren't so glamorous that it's like you needed the people to be nice, and you needed the bands that you were going to see play every night to be great, because those tours were a little rough, and it's not like they were so glamorous that you could let people that weren't nice slide by, because it was like we're all in this together, and there are going to be a couple nights on this tour that actually really suck. But it's like you knew the people were nice, and you liked the bands, but there was no sense of like, oh, this is Chris from Mineral. He's going to be, you know, someone that people are like fawning over in 15 years. There was no sense of that. It was like, oh, this guy actually was nice enough to walk over and say, I know your band. I bought your single. And I understand why you aren't just in like a grunge band or a ska band or any of the things that would make your life easier in 1994, you know?
Can you talk about that? Because I think that was an interesting, like, 94 was definitely the, I was in high school at the time, and, you know, it was so many different things converging, and if it was ska or was it, you know, grunge, I mean, and then for you guys to not sound like that, and then someone notice it, it must have been such a weird thing, because every inkling in your body must be like, all right, we're in a band, we're gonna sound like this, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't – you can't fake it, I guess, is the thing. It's like, you know, when it comes to being in a band or in sort of other creative, you know, output or extension of yourself, it's like you can think on paper, oh, it would make my life easier to do this. You know, it's like – but you can't.
Yeah.
You can't fake it, and you wouldn't be good at it anyway. You know, it's like I would be – you know, I just, it's like you have to, your heart has to be in it. And again, it goes back to the thing of like, none of that stuff was so glamorous that you would do it because you thought it was the path toward rock stardom or coolness or any of that. Like, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't cool. It wasn't what was happening at the time.
Yeah, no, definitely. It was definitely doing something, but there was a community around it that was connecting. And you had like-minded, which I think was what made it great, is that it was kind of – it wasn't like you were going against what everything was. It was, this is what feels good, and this is what we want to do. And you guys were connecting those dots. That's awesome. That's really cool, those early tours and meeting all those people. And, yeah, it's like everyone thinks, oh, God, must have been so great back then. Guess what? No one fucking showed up. You know, sometimes.
Yeah, you know, someone digs out a flyer and they, you know, post it on somewhere on the internet, and you see people freaking out, being like, oh my God, I'd give my, you know, left arm to have been at that show. And it's like, you didn't want to be at that show. I was at that show. You didn't, it wasn't, you know, it was like, it's not how you thought, it's not how you think it probably was.
Yeah. Yeah. The first times I was seeing Jimmy Eat World and Promise Ring, it was at colleges or VFWs, and there was, you know, you could kind of, you knew everybody in the room. It wasn't like this tertiary group of people that found out about it from the radio. I think too, two years later, you guys had Day 3 of My Life, which Mark Trombino produced. And I mean, that was just, I was looking back at kind of the year. I mean, he had done Boy's Life, Jimmy, No Knife, Boilermaker. And I think that same year he did Dude Ranch.
Yeah, he did the Blink-182 record after us. I don't know if it was the same year, but I know that it was after us.
Yeah, but it just, that's, I mean, it was so much stuff, you know, happening at that moment. Was it the same? What expectations? I mean, obviously, yes, I understand you guys want to do successful, be the band, but what were kind of you guys thinking, like, this is what we think is going to happen, or what were your thoughts from that record?
Here's what we were thinking. We were thinking that we didn't like the way our first record sounded. Mm-hmm. And now I sort of – it's like I couldn't listen to that record for a long time without just sort of cringing at certain things about the way that it sounded. And now I'm over it, and it just reminds me of the time, and it sort of charms me in that way and distracts me from the other more technical thoughts. But we were thinking that, you know, I mean, I remember thinking, why does, like, the snare sound on the Boys Life record that they probably spent like $1,000 making sounds infinitely better than any snare that I've ever recorded. And, like, why is this so hard? Like, why can't we, like, who's the guy that will, like, get us and we can say, you know, we can talk in that way that I was talking earlier. Mm-hmm. Like, I want the snare sound from, you know, the first Fugazi record or whatever you might say to someone and just have them get it and be like, well, you're not going to get that, but I know what I like. I get the reference type of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we want, you know, it's like Seaweed used to have like the Seaweed records sounded good and they had big guitars. And so we're like, well, they just do that themselves. And like, why is this so hard for us to like figure out? Why don't we like the way our first record does? And so in searching for the guy that could sort of speak our language, it was like, well, this guy, he just so happens to be the drummer of Drive Like Jehu. And so like, that's a pretty solid trump card when you're both talking about, I guess threefold for me because he's a drummer. So it's like one, yeah, you're going to be able to like talk a common language with him because it's like you're not going to have to explain things when the guy's in this band that you totally love. I mean, I listened to Drive Like Jehu this week. two, he has played on good sounding records and he's made good sounding records. So like you don't have to worry about that. And then like three, like Mark Trombino is 100 times better at playing the drums than I am. So like it was easy to say like this guy's got this, you know, like mm-hmm. we can sort of hand the reins over to this guy and he will lead us to down the path of records that sound good, which we didn't think our first record did.
Wow.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, that's
and he didn't disappoint. I mean, the first thing he had us do was like, well, we're not just going to step into the studio. We're going to do like a week of pre-production, and you guys are going to come down here and like we're going to like sort of sort out these songs together. Which, and you know, and we would go into situations like that. We were a bit of a ramshackle bunch, and he didn't know us. He didn't know that about us yet, but he found it out quickly, and it was like, it was a little bit like school's in, like. Like you guys get, I'll push record when I think you're ready for me to push record, and that time isn't right now. Clearly, you
wow.
know. And so, and he would. I mean, he. But again, nicest guy ever. He's the sweetest guy ever. But he was like, I'm not gonna let you. I'm not gonna do that to you. Like that. When you guys think you're playing to get, like you guys think you're playing the same thing during that part. But you're not playing the same thing. And he was, you know, and he was right. So we would break it down and we'd be like, okay, what do you think we're doing right here? And, you know, it's like, oh, we weren't on the same page. Thanks for that. Like, let's fix it. And then like, okay, once we, you know, and it's like, okay, one song done, on to the next. And he could just sit there and be a producer, you know, and be like a guy who's like, I want you guys to be ready to make a solid record.
That's awesome. What were some of the standouts from that record that you dig?
Decorate the Spine's a good time, and the thing I remember is in the middle part, it ended up getting mixed fairly low, but there's like some guitar shrill chaos that happens sort of like in the breakdown part where it's just mm-hmm. me playing drums, Blair singing, and I think everything else is just like feedback. And I totally dig that. Like I dig like the dissonance that's happening in that part right there. I'm like, hey Mark, what do you think of it? And he's like, I think you're ruining a perfectly good pop song.
Oh, that's awesome.
it's like, wait, the guy from Drive Like Jehu is like telling us like, don't fuck with your pop song. But I'm glad we kept it, and you know I like that part. But I just remember like it was like the ultimate vote of non-confidence. Like,
and you were so stoked to ask him, and then
bad
like,
idea.
No. Yeah, bad idea, buddy.
Yeah, totally.
That's awesome. Anything from those? You know what tours were happening in 97? Were there the same bands, the same era? Was it starting to change? Did you start to see the audience change? Or for 97 for me, I was doing a radio show at the time as well in college, and the band, like, I could just feel the records coming in. If it was Crank sending them one day, or if it was a label from the East Coast, and what were some stuff from that time frame?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that was both. I think the record we made was I think the first, it was like the first record was us figuring out how to make a record. The second record was like statement of purpose. And I think, like, I don't know if we meant to do that, but it's like we pared down to a 3-piece. We did it with Mark. And when in doubt, those songs are like a little simpler. Like, we were very into, like, you know, we just sort of pared it down, and that was, in my mind, that was sort of our statement of purpose record. And I think that coincided with things like you said, where it started to be like, this is a thing. There's a thing going on. There are bands that sound like this, and they're on these couple labels, and they tour together, and they play these types of venues, and it sort of started. It was happening, you know. It was like, still wasn't the coolest thing. It still wasn't like, but it had started to even take over college radio, which was a new thing. I mean, I think that was sort of the 5-year era where those bands like started to do really well in college radio. And I think the tour that I remember from that record was Jimmy Eat World, Synth Field, and us together for most of the country. And you know, it was kind of like a piecemeal tour where each band did a little, like each band could sort of like cover off on a region of the country. It's like Synth Field was was a pretty big band and like sort of like the Northeast hardcore region. They mm-hmm. you know, it's like they had that sort of like revelation cachet. And then Jimmy World sort of, you know, did well like Midwest, you know, places closer to their home. And so that was, you know, I mean, it wasn't a perfect tour. It wasn't it was by no means like a crazy successful tour, but it was three bands that liked each other. It was three bands that got along well, that was the tour we did behind that record, I think, and probably some others that I'm forgetting, and who knows what else.
I think that the friends that make fun of you for remembering stuff, you're great. You're remembering a lot more than like.
But you don't know that half the shit could be like completely out of order, or like that's not the right tour for that record.
Well,
it's like you're throwing out yours, and I'm just trusting you. It's like if you say that Day 3 of Mighty Life came out in 97, I'm probably right. But I'll decorate spine for her. And we're not who we might prefer. Motives move so self-assured. Settle down me, a black and an empty hole. Fast and unfriendly, I beg to revise the road. Sure, so I have a website called Swimmingly that's about the intersection of independent music and food culture. So I'm all over that.
I love your site.
Oh, cool.
That's
awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I've been doing it for a little over a year now, and I curated the food at this music festival that's happening this weekend up in Sonoma that I'm super excited about.
Well, then, wait, hold on a second. Did I bug you? I might have followed you on Swimmingly and not even known that you were in Knapsack. because you had done, I forget the interview you might, I don't remember, I'm trying to remember which one tipped me off to it, but it was super cool, and I love the aesthetic of it and everything, and then for...
Oh, thank you.
And then, so, again, that was really awesome. You were doing, like, I just love the vibe of it.
That's exciting. Thank you so much.
I don't know if you remember some nerd that was hitting me up.
Super fun for me.
Yeah, I was looking at a AP from 97, and I had saved it somehow, because Helmet was on the cover, and I was a big Helmet fan at that time. They were, like, to me, such a great band, and it was metal, but it wasn't. And there was an ad for the record in there, for Day 3 of My New Life, and I just was kind of like, wow, this is what you had to do. You had to put it in the AP. It was, you know, radio was still king. You know, there wasn't, you know, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, Vine, Makeout Club, any of those, LiveJournal.
None of that stuff. I mean, Knapsack never had an official website or anything like that.
That's what I love to hear. Look at that. We're talking about bands that didn't even have websites. This is perfect.
Yeah. Podcasts were only a twinkle in our eye.
Nerding out. I was too, I think, with 98 conversations ending right now, that was soon after. Was it, am I getting the dates wrong? Of course, maybe I'm asking the wrong person. But it was definitely soon after. Did you guys have a ton of songs that you were just ready to put out?
No, we never had a ton of songs. In fact, I think there are 10 songs on each record because contractually, I think our contract said a full-length record is no less than 10 songs and no less than 40 minutes.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So that song, Cellophane, it's funny. I don't listen to – I don't know what any of the Knapsack lyrics mean. I didn't write any of them. And I'm not someone to listen – who listens to other people's lyrics. I'm usually listening to either like the song as a whole or drums or whatever. But 40 more than I can take today, I'm pretty sure refers to this idea of we had to figure out how to make a 40-minute long record and probably had about 22 minutes of material at the time.
So there is no bonus tracks lying around.
No, I mean, the studio that we recorded Silver Sweepstakes in, and then we also did one or two like compilation or like we, I think we did the Crank song, the Don't Forget to Breathe song there, and maybe Dropkick from the Stuntman 7-inch. I think that's what we did there. So I just got a bit – that label or that studio closed, and John, who's a super nice guy, the guy who owns it, sent me – he called me up or whatever the 2013 version of that is, sent me some sort of message and said, hey, I've got a box of Knapsack tape, like analog tape here. Where can I send it? And so I just got – I don't think there's anything interesting on that, but I'll find a way to figure it out here one of these days.
Nice. I like this. I think you should.
But we were not a prolific band, and so odds are that if something is on there, it's because it belongs there. And
yeah.
If there was something usable, we were happy to – add it to the list and have that be one less song we had to sort out.
I think that some of the record, some of the songs from that last record definitely spoke to a lot of people, and Skip the Details, Catherine the Great, Balancing Act. What were any of those favorites for you? Or just, I think that for me, that sounded like, I love the sound of that record. We play, actually, this past weekend, or past week, we had Catherine the Great requested, and people like usually request stuff from that record. It sounds fucking great loud, and that's what I love about some of these, you know, era records, that you can play them super loud, and they started to sound better. What was some of the things from that recording that stuck out?
We didn't track that with Mark. He mixed it, but we tracked it with Alex Newport.
Mm-hmm.
Who?
Oh, fuck yeah, Alex.
He did. Yeah, he did the early At the Drive-In stuff,
and he was in Fudge Tunnel.
We did in San Francisco, and he was in the band Fudge Tunnel. He's a nice guy, you know, he and Mark have a very different. We didn't know who was going to mix it, and we thought maybe even Alex might mix it. And I don't remember how it all came to be, but it was to hand. It's on paper. It's a weird record that the way that the tracks sounded when they were handed to Mark were like. It's like the way those guys record things is pretty disparate. And so like for Mark to get like a snare drum that's like pretty like that's tuned pretty low, like versus tight, you know, mm-hmm. and like to have to figure out what to do with that. Like it didn't make sense on paper and it could have been a really bad idea, but I like the way that that record sounds and I like the songs and, I mean, I think, like I said earlier, like the first record is us just trying to figure out how to be a band, make a record, whatever else. Second record is sort of like statement of purpose, like pare down and just sort of like get the simple things right. And then the third record, this conversation, was us like okay, I think we can stretch out a little bit. Like Sergi had joined the band and he's a good guitar player, and we were, you know, it's like it sounds silly, but like OK Computer had come out and there was just like something in the air that was like a little bit more of like it's, you know, like it was a time to kind of like stretch out a little bit. People were putting like analog synths on records that where they wouldn't normally belong and sort of like loopy stuff. And you know, we had fun with some of that. There's the weird, like Alex loop, my, the thing at the end of, one of the songs, that's like a drum loopy thing, mm-hmm. or maybe might be construed as a drum solo, is like him like just trying to get like mic sounds early on in the recording, and him just like saying, hey, go play drums for 20 minutes while I like get this, like try to get like levels and stuff. And then he took that and then like did that crazy mashup at the end. So it's like,
awesome.
That's like, it's like strewn together, and it's not like one thing that I played together. It's like, you know, it's like 18 different parts like patched together, and that was just sort of like the vibe of that, which was like stretch out a little bit.
Oh, that's awesome. And of course that time too was, that was 98, was pretty nuts. Touring wise, was it the same, was it different, were your things starting to change, did you see people, you know, was it seeing other bands succeed or getting to certain points? And it just, that time felt, especially in the scene, it just seemed like people were starting to get picked off or they were breaking up.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a lot more, it felt more like an end than a beginning to me, looking back at that time. I mean, music was in a pretty sad place at that time. It's like, any sort of like post Nirvana coolness had quickly, or had over the years sort of turned to Creed, which turned to like Limp Bizkit. And then the boy band thing was big at the time, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And so like music was in a pretty sorry state of affairs in terms of like the mainstream. And if Jimmy Eat World had like wasn't dropped that year, it's like they were, I mean, that was sort of like the era when they got dropped. It pretty much, the bands that we played with most often had broken up, and we were kind of figuring out how it was all going to, if there was going to be like a next step, or if we were going to call it a day. And I don't think we had said, so the tour we did behind that was with At the Drive-In. And I don't think going into that tour, we had said this is the last tour, but I had a job where I had to do that tour as like my 2 weeks of paid time off, which, and that was the first time that had happened. I didn't have a job before that, but I had a job. I'd moved to San Francisco, and it costs a lot more to live here than where I was living before. And so I took a job. And so any sort of knapsack tour had to be like 2 weeks paid time off. And so because of that, we had to do it differently. And we had to like say like, okay, well, we can only, so what we ended up doing was, I had seen At the Drive-In and they were bananas. And But I had only seen them because our booking agent said we wanted to do a tour where we said we need to go, we need to like borrow the back line from, we need to play on another band's instruments and we need to fly to where they are and like do, we could do the West Coast, no problem, but we need to fly to where they are and do like Chicago East mm-hmm. with them and playing their instruments. And so our booking agent, who became at the drive-in's manager through all like the crazy huge stuff, said, go see this band at the drive-in. They like you guys. They'd probably let you play their instruments. They like your records. And so I went and saw at the drive-in in San Francisco in front of like 20 people. And I don't know if you saw them like back
I
early
did.
On, but like that, I mean, you know, they would take 20 people and just like blow their doors off. And I mean, you could put them in front of anyone, but it didn't matter how few people were there. They were going to do what they were going to do, and it was going to be bonkers.
Yeah,
and so
I
was like,
oh, sorry. I was going to say, no, it was the tour that I saw was Jimmy Eat World at the drive-in and Lazy Kane.
Okay.
And there's a friend found a video online from that show. Someone shot a VHS tape of them playing Fahrenheit. And it's when I explain to people sort of that time frame and them, I play them that video because it's insane.
Oh yeah, I mean, they were, you know, it's like you saw them for 2 minutes and you're like, well, I don't know if this is going to be mainstream huge or what kind of huge, but like this is special and this is different and this just feels like raw energy in a really cool way.
Was that at the drive-in the last tour and then you guys broke up? What was the – did it kind of linger and then it was – you guys broke up in 2000 or
– happened to be the 15th anniversary of like that last proper tour. So we got home and I got a job at eMusic and that was like, well, this is like a real job and it's what I wanted. You know, it was like a – marketing job and it was like what I wanted to do as a career or what I wanted to do next and what I've ended up doing. And so that kind of made things more complicated because it's like, well, I can't do a bunch of things. Certainly, I mean, and I think maybe I was wrong to assume like I couldn't do several things at once, but I just felt like I owed it my full attention. And I wanted to start a family and I wanted to maybe figure out a way to buy a house. And I, you know, it's like, it was just that time. It was like, well, I don't know what we're going to do next as a band. And, but I know that I want to take this job seriously and I want to sort of shore things up financially for myself and figure out what I'm going to do next. So we got home from that tour and I took that job. And then there was this weird thing that happened where so 3 records for Alias was what we owed them unless a major label came along and unless they did like a partnership with a major label. And so we were out of our contract with Alias. To make new records. And so we didn't know what we were going to do next. And Interscope, of all people, started sniffing around. And I think at the time, I think there was one guy at Epitaph that got us and pretty much said they'd sign us. But Epitaph was a pretty tough guy back then. Like it was before
Anti.
Yeah, and some other things that they've done. And so, you know, to me, Epitaph was like Pennywise, and that was never my thing. So that felt like it was going to be weird. And it also didn't feel like it was going to be like all that different. Like, you know, it's like, you know, what would a fourth record be like? And, you know, and so Interscope started sniffing around, and we actually went down and we played this show in front of Jimmy Iovine, like a private show in front of Jimmy Iovine and this guy, Tom Wally, who was...
I've interviewed with Tom Wally.
Oh, yeah. So you know who that is.
Yes.
Record industry hotshot. And we played like a private show at the at where did Rivers Phoenix die? What's that place called? Cheesy LA.
Roxy?
No. The Viper Room.
Viper Room.
So we played like a private show at the Viper Room for Tom Wally and Jimmy Iovine. And it went – we played old songs and new songs. And afterward, we sat down and we had a drink with Jimmy Iovine. He's like, I think we're going to sell a lot of records together. And we're like, this is bizarre. Okay, this is so weird. But, you know, it was sort of like a time where it was like, well, if we're going to continue to do this, we should, like, do this in a different way. And all sorts of weird shit's happening. And so, like, I don't know. Maybe we should go be on Interscope, you know. We were certainly open to the idea.
Yeah.
And so it went from like, I think we're going to sell a lot of records together. And they said, like, in these situations, like, I mean, like, these guys will just get up and leave in the middle of your first song if they're like not into it or whatever. And so we're like, oh God, that would suck. So they stay through the whole thing. He says, I think we're going to sell a lot of records together. And then it was like, and then nothing. Like, and then they don't return your calls.
Oh, that's classic. That's classic.
Yeah. And, you know, we were sort of like, well, that's fine. And that probably would have been weird anyway. And so we said, well, we need to do, like, I don't know how much we had done on the West Coast after that record had come out. So we felt like we needed to do, like, a little something on the West Coast, even if it was going to be the last thing we did. So we set up some shows for, I want to say, January of 99, and it was San Francisco, Orange County, L.A., and then Blair and I had a conversation where I said, you know, I think I'm ready to not do this anymore, and, you know, we've been friends for so long, and it's just, I think, you know, it's, I don't think he wanted to be done doing music. Obviously he continued to be doing music, but I think he knew me well enough to know, like, I know what you want to go do. I know you want to go start a family, and I know you want to, like, start a career. And I know, you know, like, I kind of always, you know, knew that this point would come maybe or something. Anyway, you know, it's like, we're buddies. We've known each other forever. And so, you know, it was a hard conversation to have, but it wasn't like, you know, it was just, okay, that's the plan. That's what we'll do. And we'll play these last three shows. And there wasn't like a way to, like, make a grandiose, yeah. You know, it's like, there wasn't a place online to say, like, hey, these are our last shows. Some people knew, some people didn't. We knew in advance, but it, like, there was no way to have it be like, you know, it was not the last waltz. It was just like, we'll just go play these shows, and it's sort of like in a somewhat workmanlike fashion. And San Francisco was amazing, and that was a great night. And then we went down and we played, and that show was with Sinsfield, and I don't know who else with the San Francisco show. The last show was Sinsfield, and then we played the Chain Reaction in Orange County somewhere, maybe Anaheim. Not sure. And that was without the drive-in. And then we played the Troubadour in L.A. And that was without the drive-in as well. And in fact, there's a video out there. I know the guy who has it. I won't name his name, although it may have to come to that for us to get it out of his paws. But there's a video of that. I have a cassette tape of the audio from that last night. But there's also a video from it, and Omar from At the Drive-In comes out and plays tambourine or shakers on Decorate the Spine, and it was a pretty special night and a pretty great way for us to go out.
How are we going to get this video? we need to time this.
I'll upgrade my threats and see if that helps at all.
Is it on VHS or is it on another format? Oh,
you know it.
I convert VHS tapes. I've done a bunch of them. I did some mineral stuff. I've done a bunch of things, so I can help.
We'll keep that in mind.
Nice. So it brings us to what everyone's kind of been excited about, and I think excited to hear about the reunion and, you know, the site that you guys had set up, and to see the stuff being posted and people writing things and getting really excited. You know, it's great to see. What sparked this? And, you know, I know that it was the 15th anniversary of the last tour, but kind of were there early conversations, or was it like, hey, let's try this? And I'd love to kind of hear how it came about.
Yeah, the 15th anniversary thing is a total retrofit. It's certainly not – it has never even been a conversation that we had. I think it was me that just sort of figured that out. But, you know, I always – Blair and I had kept we keep in touch. We see each other. You know, we grew up the same place. We see each other over the holidays, usually when we're home for Christmas or whatever. And then I'll always go out and see the Jealous Sound. I think those records are amazing and just really like accomplished and smart and savvy and great. And I'll always go out and hang with Blair when they come through town. And all, those guys are nice, Bob and everybody else. And we would talk about, you know, I'm like the band archivist, and so I've got like a bunch of old photos and set lists and flyers and a bunch of stuff. And we had just sort of said like, well, it would be fun if we could get those records reissued, or if we could do like at least get them back out on vinyl and do like some cool packaging around it with like all the old stuff I have. And the Jell Sound manager Tom, who was in Sunday's Best and was in a band called Skip Loader that we played with like way back in the day, mm-hmm. He started sort of working on that, and he's a go-getter and was trying to make that happen, and it doesn't look like it's going to, but that sort of forced us to kind of have knapsack conversations, which is not something that we had done in a really long time. I mean, I would go out and I'd see Blair, I'd be hanging out with Blair, and he'd say, oh, so-and-so said a really nice thing about, you know, this kid came up and said a really nice thing about Knapsack, or told this really interesting, like, charming story about Knapsack, or so-and-so showed me, like, I think one time he said, you know, this crazy, like, somebody has a Knapsack tattoo or something like that. And it was like, there was definitely like a conversation of like, it's weird that this thing won't die, because like, we weren't a big band when this was happening, and, you know, you would just think that this would go away a little more than it has. And it's just kind of curious, like, oh, this keeps, like, it's this thing is kind of not going away, and so maybe we should put those records out. And then Tom, the Jealous Sound manager, was like, well, would you guys play shows if the records came back out? And Blair and I had always just said, because, I mean, we treat that stuff with kid gloves just because, like, you know, we're always like, our friendship is more important than any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it's like, I don't want to go down any path that puts that into any sort of risk, you know? So it's like, it's easier to just have the first instinct be no, than it is to like, you know, we just want to be so careful about that. And so, you know, it was kind of like, well, I'd do it. And Blair's like, well, I'd do it. And, you know, Sergi had always sort of said like, I'm up for whatever. But we had said we were going to do it around the reissuing of the records. And again, I don't think that's going to happen. And then the festival in Florida called The Fest came through with like, I think they had heard that these conversations were maybe happening a little bit, that it wasn't out of the question. And so they threw out an offer. And that was the first time where we had to like, instead of just continue saying maybe to each other, like, we owed someone an answer. Like, we owed someone an answer, yes or no. Like, all right, are you guys going to play this show or not? Like, mm-hmm. You know, it's like I threw out like a formal offer. Like, you can say no, of course, but like, you can't just, you know, it can't be like, oh, we'll pick up this conversation next time Blair comes through San Francisco. Like, this is not going to wait for that. And that's kind of how that conversation had gone. It had been like a multi, you know, it had been kind of over time that we had warmed up to the idea a little bit.
You know, what's interesting is I had emailed Blair when I heard things and the nerdery that my circles that I roll in, and I emailed him, "Hey, what's going on?" And all he wrote back was, "What rumors?"
Yeah.
So there was there denial until the announcement, or was it you might have been still going back and forth?
I don't know. When was this?
I can look at the Gmail. I mean, it was definitely before anything was announced, but not that far off.
Oh yeah, no, it was probably just denial.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
I got a couple. I returned a couple of emails that were like, "Oh, that sounds really interesting. What did you hear and who from?" You know, just because. You know, if you're trying to keep the cat in the bag, you're trying to keep the cat in the bag. What's the point of, like, you know, it's the internet after all. It's not like, it's not like the shit doesn't spread like wildfire. We're all pretty excited about it. And you know, I mean, we're just, it's all about having fun. It's all about hanging out again, staying super positive, and just having a, you know, crazy appreciation for the idea that we can actually do this, because honestly, 15 years ago, if you would have said people are going to give half a shit in 2013, I would have thought you were crazy.
Thanks again for listening to the Washed Up Emo podcast. I'm going to keep going as long as I can, as long as my hours in the day stay. Follow me on Twitter at Washed Up Emo, or Zuckerberg's site, facebook.com/washedupemo. And if you're ever in New York City, come hang with us every first Thursday at Idle Hands Bar for Emo Night. So until next time, thanks.